A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I want to tell you something I've never said on this show before. For 10 years, renting in Israel, I have been kicked out of 6 different apartments. Not because I'm a bad tenant. I'm a sloth, Herman. I barely make noise. But Israeli tenant protection law is basically a suggestion. The landlord can decide they want the place back, or their cousin needs it, or they just feel like renovating, and you're out. 60 days notice if you're lucky. Once, 2 weeks. And when that happens enough times, something shifts in your relationship to the things you own. You start looking at your possessions differently. They're not permanent fixtures in a permanent home. They're cargo. They're what survives the next move. And somewhere around move number 4, I found myself in the kitchen at 2 in the morning with a rotary engraving tool, carving serial numbers into the bottom of my cookware.
This is the inventory system you've mentioned, the engraving plus paint marker approach.
And I know how that sounds. It sounds like a guy who's lost the plot, hunched over a stockpot with a Dremel, muttering about asset tracking. But here's the thing, that system worked. It survived moves 5 and 6. It survived outdoor storage, Tel Aviv sun, rain, abrasion. And when I stepped back and asked myself why I'd spent an entire weekend engraving my belongings, the answer wasn't just practical. It was something much older.
Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking us to go there. He's been deep in the weeds on labeling and inventory for a while. He's done episodes on adhesives, on thermal transfer, on paint pens. But he says the detour that fascinated him most was discovering engraving. And he's asking the bigger question, why have humans, across tens of thousands of years, been drawn to the act of cutting into a surface to make a mark? What does it say about us that when stability is disrupted, when our sense of place is threatened, we respond by physically carving our presence into the world?
Which is exactly the question I had to confront at 2A, with a Dremel in my hand. Am I just tracking my stuff? Or am I doing something that humans have done since before we had language for it?
That's what we want to trace today. We're going from a workbench in Jerusalem back 75,000 years to the first known engravings, then forward through the technology of permanent marking, and finally to what this means for anyone listening who's ever felt the urge to carve their name into something.
Because here's the part that grabbed me. In an age of digital everything, cloud storage, NFTs, streaming libraries where you own nothing, we still reach for physical marks. We still want to cut into something solid and say, this is mine, I was here, this mattered. That impulse hasn't gone anywhere. If anything, it's getting louder.
What strikes me is that Daniel's question isn't really about inventory. It's about what inventory does for the person keeping it. The system is the symptom. The engraving is the thing itself.
And once you see it that way, the whole history of humans scratching marks into things stops looking like a timeline of graph techniques and starts looking like a single continuous behavior. Same impulse, different tools.
Let's name the two threads we're pulling here because they're braided together, but they're not the same thing. One is the engineering problem. How do you make a mark that outlasts you? Surface adhesion, UV degradation, mechanical keying, all of that. The other is the psychological driver. Why does making that mark matter so much in the first place?
They feed each other. The engineering gets more sophisticated because the psychological need is so deep. Nobody invests thousands of years refining engraving technology just to label spare parts. They do it because the act of cutting into a surface means something.
And the core tension underneath all of this is simple but brutal. Humans crave permanence. We want things to last. But we live inside systems that are fundamentally impermanent. Rental markets, sure, but also climate, politics, time itself.
Engraving is a physical protest against that fact. When you paint a label onto a smooth surface, you're asking nicely. When you cut a groove into it and then fill that groove with pigment, you're not asking, you're insisting.
That insistence is what connects a 75,000-year-old piece of engraved ochre from Blombo's cave to a serial number on the bottom of a saucepan in Jerusalem. The tools are different, the context is different, but the gesture is identical.
Which is why I think this lands for a tech audience. Even though we're talking about stone carvings, the whole promise of the digital world is frictionless impermanence. Everything updatable, everything replaceable, nothing fixed. And people are exhausted by it.
There's a reason vinyl came back. There's a reason people still buy printed books. The physical mark carries weight that the digital one doesn't, and engraving is the most extreme version of that. It's not just physical, it's subtractive. You can't undo it. You're committing.
The arc we're tracing today starts on my workbench, which is where Daniel's exploration started too. Then we go back to the earliest known engravings. Blombo's Bimbetka, the first time a human being decided to cut a pattern into something that would outlast their own body. Then we follow the technology forward. Bronze Burins, Morse's marble cutter, laser engraving. And finally we come back to what this means for someone listening right now who's staring at their own belongings and feeling that same urge to mark them.
The practical question underneath all of it is, if you're going to do this, how do you do it so it actually lasts? Because the impulse is ancient, but the materials are modern, and most people get the engineering wrong.
And we'll get into why adhesive labels fail, why paint alone chips off, and why a $30 rotary tool plus a $5 paint marker outperforms systems that cost 10 times as much. But the engineering only makes sense once you understand what you're really trying to do. You're not just identifying an object, you're pushing back against the thing that keeps kicking you out of your home.
Walk me through the actual system. You're in the kitchen at 2A with a Dremel. What are you doing, technically?
Rotary engraving tool. Mine's a Dremel 4000. But any rotary tool that hits 20 to 35,000 RPM will do the job. Carbide burr bit, not a grinding stone. The burr cuts. It doesn't abrade. You want a groove about half a millimeter to 1 millimeter deep. Deep enough to hold paint. Shallow enough not to compromise the material. On plastic storage bins, I go lighter. On metal tools, I lean in a bit more.
Then the paint marker goes into the groove.
Oil-based, Sharpie Professional or Uni Paint, something that bonds with the substrate and cures rather than drying on top. The groove does two things. First, it increases the surface area the paint can grip by roughly 3 times compared to a flat surface. More surface, more adhesion. Second, and this is the part people miss, the groove physically shields the paint from abrasion. When something scrapes across the surface, the paint sitting inside a recessed channel doesn't get touched. The surrounding material takes the hit.
That's the mechanical keying principle. Paint on a smooth surface fails because there's nothing for it to lock into. It's just sitting on top. A single scratch and the edge lifts, then moisture gets under and the whole thing peels off in sheets.
Which is exactly what happened when I tried paint markers alone. Looked great for about 3 weeks, then started flaking at the edges. The groove solves that. It's the difference between writing on a wall and carving into it.
This is why adhesive labels are a non-starter for anything that sees sunlight or weather. The ASTM D2103 standard testing on acrylic adhesives, the stuff on the back of most label stock, shows they lose about 50% of their tensile strength after 500 hours of UV exposure. That's roughly 2 months of direct sun. After that, the adhesive turns brittle, the label curls, and it's gone.
I tested this on my bicycle frame, engraved a serial number into the bottom bracket, filled it with white paint marker. That bike lived outside in Tel Aviv, full Mediterranean sun, winter rain, salt air, for 3 years. The mark looked fresh when I sold it. Meanwhile, I'd laminated a paper label and stuck it on the seat tube as a control. It peeled off in under 2 weeks.
2 weeks versus 3 years and counting.
The laminated label was the premium option. The one the office supply store tells you is for outdoor use. The engraving plus paint cost me maybe $35 in tools and consumables, and I can mark 100 items before the paint marker runs dry.
Embossing has the same fundamental problem as paint alone. It works, but only on thin materials that can deform. You're not embossing a cast iron pan or a hardwood tool handle. And even when it works, the raised surface is exposed to wear in a way a recessed groove isn't.
Every alternative has a failure mode. Embossing limits your materials. Laser engraving is beautiful, but costs hundreds of dollars and can't do everything a hand tool can on curved or awkward surfaces. The rotary tool plus paint marker is the thing that actually works across the board.
That's the engineering, but the engineering only exists because of the thing driving it. You said 6 moves in 10 years.
And the first 3, I didn't mark anything. I just packed and unpacked and tried to remember which box held the kitchen stuff. By move 4, something had cracked open. I wasn't just organizing, I was claiming.
There's a body of work in environmental psychology on exactly this. When housing stability collapses, repeated displacement, weak tenancy rights, the sense that you could be uprooted at any moment, people develop what researchers call territorial marking behaviors. It's compensatory. You can't control whether you get to stay, so you control what you can, the objects themselves and the marks that say they're yours.
It felt less like inventory management and more like saying, these things are real, I am real, and no matter where I end up next, this saucepan is coming with me and it will have my mark on it.
That's not neurosis. It's a completely legible response to precarity. The research actually shows an interesting split. Housing instability correlates with lower emotional attachment to possessions overall, because you learn not to get too attached to things you might lose. But it also correlates with these bursts of intense marking behavior around the possessions you do keep. You detach from the mass of stuff and hyper-attach to the core.
Which is exactly what happened. I got rid of half my belongings and engraved the other half. The reduction and the marking were part of the same impulse. I was curating what mattered, and then making sure it couldn't be erased.
Carving your name into a tree, scratching initials into a school desk, cutting a cross into a cave wall. These aren't different behaviors from what you did to your cookware. They're the same gesture with different tools. The tree carving says, I stood here. The serial number says, this object and I belong to each other.
Both of them are responses to the same thing. The tree doesn't care. The cave wall doesn't care. The universe is indifferent to whether you existed. The mark is a rebuttal.
A small, scratchy, half-millimeter deep rebuttal.
The paint stays in the groove.
The impulse to cut into things isn't unique to me, or to renters in Tel Aviv. Let's go back 75,000 years to see where this all started.
Blombo's Cave, South Africa. Pieces of ochre with cross-hatched patterns deliberately engraved into them. Archaeologists have argued about what they mean for decades, but the consensus now is that these are the earliest known symbolic markings made by Homo sapiens. Not tools, not accidents. Someone sat down and chose to cut a pattern into a surface that would outlast them.
That's the key phrase, outlast them. The ochre itself is soft, you can scratch it with a harder stone. It's not durable in the way granite is durable, but the impulse is already fully formed. Make a mark that says something after you're gone.
Christopher Henshelwood's team at Blombo's has been excavating there since the early 90s, and what keeps coming up is that these engravings weren't decorative in the way we think of art. They were acts of claiming. The cave was occupied repeatedly over thousands of years, and each group left marks. It's territorial behavior, 75 millennia before my Dremel.
It wasn't isolated. Bimbetka in India, rock shelters with petroglyphs dating back roughly 30,000 years. Cupulas, which are those small circular depressions ground into the rock surface, hundreds of them in patterns across multiple sites. Nobody was making those for fun. The effort involved in grinding a depression into hard quartzite with a handheld stone is enormous.
You're basically spending hours to make a dent. That's not casual doodling. That's ritual. That's someone saying, this place is ours, and we're going to physically alter it so nobody can pretend we weren't here.
Here's where the connection to Daniel's inventory tags gets uncomfortable in an interesting way. When you engrave your cookware, you're not just tracking assets, you're asserting presence. The territory is smaller. It's the bottom of a saucepan instead of a cave wall, but the gesture is the same. I am here, this is mine, and I'm cutting into the material to prove it.
Which means my 2-way Dremel session wasn't a coping mechanism in the clinical sense. It was the same behavior that humans have been doing since before we had agriculture, before we had writing, before we had anything we'd recognize as civilization. The impulse to engrave predates the wheel.
The technology tracks the impulse. Stone on stone gives way to metal on stone. By the time you get to ancient Egypt around 3000 BCE, you've got bronze burins, essentially chisels, and artisans are engraving hieroglyphs into temple walls and obelisks. The Rosetta Stone, 96 BCE, is a political document engraved in three scripts, but the medium was the message. You don't carve a tax decree into granodiorite if you just want people to read it. You do it because you want it to be unchangeable.
A stone that says, "This is the law, and it will be the law forever, because good luck erasing it." Of course, empires fall, languages die, and 2,000 years later it's in a museum. But the intent was permanence through physical alteration.
Then you get this wonderful historical detour. Morse. Yes, the telegraph guy, the Morse code guy, before he ever touched electricity, he invented a marble cutting machine in the 1820s. He was a struggling artist in New York, and he built a device that could carve three-dimensional sculptures from marble blocks using a pantograph mechanism. It was essentially the first rotary engraving machine.
Wait, Morse code? Morse invented the engraving machine.
He was a portrait painter and sculptor, and he got tired of doing it by hand. The machine used a rotating cutter guided by a tracing mechanism. You'd trace a model, and the cutter would reproduce it in marble. It didn't make him rich, but the patent exists. The same mind that later figured out how to encode language into electrical pulses first figured out how to mechanize the act of cutting into stone.
That's not a coincidence. That's a person obsessed with making marks that travel through time. First through stone, then through wire.
From Morse's pantograph, the lineage runs straight through to modern CNC engraving and laser systems. The mechanism changes. Stepper motors instead of mechanical linkages focus light instead of a carbide bit, but the core operation is identical. Remove material to create a mark that cannot be undone.
Which brings me to something I stumbled onto while I was researching this, the cognitive piece. Why does an engraved mark feel more real than a printed one?
The enactment effect.
Walk me through it.
Cognitive psychology has documented this pretty robustly. When you perform a physical action during the encoding of information, writing by hand, manipulating an object, cutting a groove, your recall of that information improves by roughly 40% compared to passive observation. The haptic feedback and the spatial memory of the movement create what researchers call a memory anchor. Your brain doesn't just store the fact, it stores the gesture that made the fact physical.
When I engrave a serial number into a tool, I'm not just labeling it. I'm wiring that tool into my memory in a way that typing the same number into a spreadsheet never could.
The spreadsheet is abstract. The groove is physical. Your hand remembers the vibration of the tool, the resistance of the material, the smell of the bit heating up. All of that gets encoded alongside the number itself. It's why you can probably remember which items you've engraved and which you haven't, even without checking.
Every single one. And I couldn't tell you what's in my digital inventory without opening the file.
That's the enactment effect in action. It's also why handwritten notes stick better than typed ones, why people remember directions better when they draw a map instead of just looking at one. The body is part of the memory system. Engraving is just the most extreme version. You're not just moving a pin, you're cutting into something.
Which means the 75,000-year-old ochre engraving at Blombos wasn't just a symbol for other people. It was a memory anchor for the person who made it. They remembered making that mark. Their hand remembered the angle of the stone, the resistance of the ochre. That mark was part of their cognition.
This is where we have to talk about the dark side of this impulse. Because territorial marking doesn't stay benign. The same drive that makes someone engrave their cookware is the drive that makes someone carve their initials into a 2,000-year-old ruin, or spray paint a gang tag on a wall, or build a border fence.
I was waiting for this. Because you can't talk about the psychology of marking territory without acknowledging that territory is inherently about exclusion. My serial number on a saucepan is harmless. But scale that impulse up, and you get people carving their names into the Colosseum, or defacing petroglyphs with modern graffiti, or asserting ownership over land by building walls.
The Rosetta Stone is a perfect example of the benign-looking version. It's a beautiful. What do you do with this? You're sitting there, you've just heard 75,000 years of humans scratching marks into things, and maybe you're feeling that same itch, the urge to make something permanent. Where do you start?
First, the practical answer, because the engineering actually matters. If you're building a home inventory system for resilience, whether you're a renter facing the next move, or you live in a disaster-prone area, or you just want your stuff trackable for decades, skip the label maker. Invest in a rotary engraving tool. $30 to $60 gets you a perfectly capable unit, plus maybe $5 for an oil-based paint marker. The upfront time cost is higher than printing stickers, but the longevity isn't measured in months. It's measured in decades.
The technique is not complicated. You don't need a steady hand like a jeweler. The burr bit does the work. You just guide it. Half a millimeter deep, fill with paint, let it cure.
I've marked everything from plastic storage bins to cast iron to hardwood tool handles. The only surface that gave me trouble was glass, and that's because glass wants to crack if you look at it wrong. For glass, skip the rotary tool and use etching cream. Different mechanism, same principle.
The second thing is less about tools and more about self-awareness. Before you start engraving everything you own, ask yourself what's actually driving it. Is this practical identification? I need to know which toolbox is mine when the moving truck unloads. Or is this about asserting permanence in a situation that feels unstable? Both are completely valid reasons to do it. But knowing the difference changes how you design your system.
That's the thing I wish someone had told me before. Move number four. If I'd understood that I was reacting to displacement, not just organizing, I would have started with the objects that mattered most instead of trying to tag everything alphabetically. I engraved a spatula before I engraved my grandfather's chisel. The spatula didn't need a serial number. The chisel did.
Which brings us to the third piece. For listeners in unstable housing situations, and there are more of you than most people realize, an inventory system isn't just about tracking stuff. It's a psychological anchor. The act of engraving creates a sense of control and continuity when everything else feels like it's sliding.
Here's how to start without getting overwhelmed. Don't try to engrave everything at once. Pick five objects. The five things you'd grab if the apartment caught fire, the five things that feel like they carry your history. Engrave those first. Not because they're the most valuable. They might be a $10 kitchen knife you've used every day for 8 years, but because they're the ones where the mark will mean something.
The enactment effect we talked about works in your favor here. When you physically cut into those five objects, you're not just labeling them. You're telling your brain, these are the things that matter. These are the things that are real. These are coming with me no matter what happens next. The groove holds the paint, but it also holds the memory.
Once you've done the five, you'll know whether the impulse is satisfied or whether you want to keep going. Some people will stop there. Others will find themselves engraving the toaster at 3 in the morning. Both are fine. The point is doing it consciously, rather than letting the anxiety drive the tool.
One thing I'd add from the clinical side. I saw this in pediatrics, actually, with kids who moved frequently. The ones who had a small set of marked, named possessions they carried from place to place coped better than the ones whose belongings were just a rotating blur of unmarked stuff. The mark says continuity. It says, this object and I have a history that survives the move.
I wish I'd had that as a kid. I just had a dubious origin story and a lot of leaves.
Your origin story is fine, Corn.
It's really not. But the point stands. Mark your five things. Use the rotary tool and the paint marker. Know why you're doing it. And if you find yourself explaining to someone why the bottom of your favorite mug has a serial number engraved into it, just tell them it's a 75,000-year-old tradition, and you're being historically conscientious.
That's one way to frame it.
It does make me wonder where this goes next. We live in a world that's betting everything on digital ownership. NFTs that say you own a thing you can't touch. Cloud storage where your photos exist on a server in Virginia. Streaming libraries where you rent access to music you'll never hold. And yet people are out there at 2 in the morning with rotary tools, carving grooves into cookware. Is engraving a relic? Or is it the counterbalance we didn't know we needed?
I think it's the counterbalance. The more frictionless and intangible ownership becomes, the more some part of us rebels. You can't hold an NFT. You can't pass down a streaming playlist to your kid. But an engraved saucepan, that thing carries the mark of someone who used it, who claimed it, who existed. The physical mark is a hedge against digital evaporation.
I suspect we're going to see more of this, not less. Housing instability isn't going anywhere. Rents are rising globally, climate displacement is accelerating, and the rental market in most cities makes my 6 moves look almost reasonable. There's a whole generation of people who've never lived anywhere long enough to feel settled. Those people are going to start engraving things.
You're predicting a market for rental-ready engraving kits.
A small rotary tool. A set of carbide burrs. A few paint markers, packaged with a guide that says, here's how you mark what matters before the next move. Sell it for $40. Call it the displacement kit. It sounds bleak, but it's actually optimistic. It's saying, your stuff is yours, and no landlord can erase that.
The kit would need a card inside, something people can read while they're sitting on the floor surrounded by boxes, explaining that this isn't just about inventory, it's about continuity.
It's about saying, I existed, I was here, and I mattered. Which is what every petroglyph and every carved initial and every serial number on the bottom of a saucepan has been saying for 75,000 years. The next time you see a name scratched into a park bench or initials carved into a tree, don't read it as vandalism. Read it as someone pushing back against the thing that told them they were temporary.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Capsaicin, the compound that gives chili peppers their heat, exhibits a rare optical property called thermochromism. When purified into crystalline form, it shifts from colorless to pale yellow as the temperature rises above 62 degrees Celsius. This was first documented in 1928 by a Soviet chemist stationed at a research outpost on the Kamchatka Peninsula, who was reportedly investigating whether local pepper varieties could serve as rudimentary temperature indicators for military equipment in subarctic conditions.
I have no idea what to do with that.
Neither do I.
One last thing before we go. If you're feeling that urge, the one we've been talking about, to make something permanent, start small. Pick your 5 objects. Not because you're anxious, not because you're preparing for disaster, but because you're alive right now and your things carry your history and that's worth marking. The groove will hold the paint, and the paint will hold the memory, and 75,000 years of humans who did the same thing will be standing right there with you.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flemingtop for producing. If you want to send us your own question about engraving, about permanence, about why you carved your name into something when you were 12, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be here, probably engraving something.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.